Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 51 for December 2014. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special Cold War Christmas edition of the Phileas Club. You'll understand why I'm saying that in just a minute. But before we launch into the show, I just want to remind everyone what this show is about. It's a monthly show where we get people from different countries, different cultures, different points of view together for about an hour to discuss what's been happening in the past month. And hopefully what you get out of it is a slightly, well, different perspective on issues or news topics that, as Westerners, most of the time, at least that's the case for me, we sort of have a set view on things, and because that's the dominant narrative. And I'm not trying to say that we're exploring like investigative journalism or anything like that. It's just that when you meet people and you talk with them and they have a different idea than you do, or maybe a different background, then you tend to look at things differently. And that's what we're trying to achieve here on this show, between friends, because keeping it friendly and enjoyable is important too, I believe. So anyway, now that is said, I'm going to introduce my two co-hosts. In the right corner, representing all of the American United States, I wasn't sure how I was going to spin that, is John Copperdome, my good friend from podcasts past. How are you doing, John?
I am doing well, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be listening to your voice once again in the well, it's not airwaves, but the internet waves. The waves in the tubes.
How are you doing? We haven't spoken in a while. Can you remind a little bit of what you're about, what you're doing?
Patrick and I met a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, doing podcasts. I used to do a podcast called Negative Cutters, where we reviewed movie trailers. And Patrick and I had a lot of fun doing a date night segment for that podcast, where we reviewed movies for dating. I don't have too much time these days for podcasts.
You get on shows when I invite you.
Yes, always happy to jump on with other people, as you know, when I'm not the one spending all the time doing all the editing.
and you're from the East Coast, right?
Yes, I am. Used to be in Connecticut. I have moved up to upstate New York, close to Canada-ish, Vermont.
Basically, East Coast means you're one of those liberal elite types who looks down on real people. Am I pegging you right?
Right. I am elitist, liberally elitist. I have a lot of elitism to spread around now.
Excellent. Now, all right. I'm teasing, of course, but your East Coast is good enough. On the other side of the ring is to represent the entirety of Russia and the Russian way of life is Pierre, also known as Piotr, who is calling in, well, from Moscow, if I'm not mistaken. How's it going, Pierre?
It's going fine. It's a lovely evening. We've just had some snow here.
Just now. It should be snowing all the time. I believe that, you know, from what I understand about Russia, it's snowing all the time, and you're most of that time when it's snowing, wrestling bears. Is that kind of an accurate picture I have in my mind?
Well, maybe it's somewhat accurate. As the thing goes, there is Moscow and there is Russia. As far as I've seen, it is winter in, let's say, Irkutsk, for 9 months a year.
Oh,
but they still don't wrestle bears.
Not all the time. I'm sure. Yeah, please don't destroy all of my,
you're ruining his childhood.
Just at least from time to time, they wrestle bears, right? All right, I'm gonna stop.
No, but, see, when they're not wrestling bears, they're distilling vodka by pouring it through, you know, like the drain pipes. Isn't that right?
It does sometimes happen, though not in the central part of Russia.
All right. Thanks so much for joining as well, Pierre. I know it's your first appearance in a podcast, I believe. So thank you so much.
So if you're calling him Pierre, can I call him Peter? Isn't that the American?
It will do.
Well, so no, now I have to explain. I'm not calling you Pierre because I want to pronounce it the French way. You told me that your name was actually Pierre.
As my passport says, my name is Piotr, but my parents named me Pierre after Pierre Bezukhov from Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. But the Soviets didn't allow foreign names in the 80s.
Mm. So they chose Piotr as your official name, but really your name Pierre.
Well, sort of.
Kind of. Can you tell us a little bit about your situation? Nothing too specific, but
nothing that they can track you down by.
Yeah, basically. But you know where you're from. You're in Moscow, and I don't know. Just a few words, so listeners can get a sense of who you are, more or less.
Well, I am a 26 years old programmer from Moscow. I work for Russian railroads.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to do and to speak much with the eastern part of Russians.
Okay, that's actually interesting because the eastern part of Russia is, well, further to the east, and it's often, you know, it's easy to forget how gigantic Russia is. But all right, you know what? We are going to be talking about Russia quite a bit in this show, and that's why I'm so glad to have you on, Pierre. But before we even start with this month's topics, I don't want to get you in trouble in any way, and that's something I said when we started conversing via email, but I do have this image of activity on the internet in Russia being not heavily, but somewhat controlled. It has become more and more, maybe not controlled, but surveyed, and maybe you shouldn't say too many things, and maybe you shouldn't have too much of a controversial blog, because Putin has been cracking down on some of the most strongest opposition voices in the country. Is that not a concern at all for you, or is that an inaccurate, again, sentiment that we have in the West, or...?
It's not that inaccurate, though the people whose blogs and pages were banned from the internet, at least Russian part of it, were somewhat calling for it. They were stirring the trouble where it shouldn't be stirred. It's not that hard to keep off the radar.
To keep what, sorry?
To keep off the radar. Am I saying it not right?
Off their radar.
Okay.
I see. So, well, I don't think, you know, the Phileas Club is really a big hit in Russia. I don't think anyone is going to, not too many people are going to listen to it.
Don't insult your Russian listeners.
There's no, of course. That's
scores
not
scores of them.
No, the Phileas Club has a relatively modest audience. So that's what I mean. But so it's interesting that you're saying they were stirring trouble where it shouldn't be stirred. Are there things that you can and can't say when you're prolific on well in media? I'm sure there is in media in Russia, in general as well.
Well, officially there are no such things, and I don't happen to know of any, though I've seen some. As they are called, independent reports from the opposition. Well, I'm not sure how independent they were, because it was said on them who funded them. Yeah. And it was not a couple of independent people.
Okay. All right.
Well, so in politics, there's always struggle. If you don't do politics, and you don't make people, well, go on the streets and
riot?
riot, light up the Kremlin or something like that.
So are you saying that it's less about what you say and more about how much of an effect you can have with what you say?
Pretty much so, and it's always been. Though in Stalin's Russia, you could have been sent to Gulag for 15 years for an anecdote.
Well, I guess it's interesting that you're saying it like that, because for me, it's kind of the same thing. What you say and whether or not what you say has an effect. Obviously, if you're saying doesn't have an effect, then it's really not a problem. But if the government is saying it's okay to say, well, not the government, but the atmosphere is you can say whatever you want, as long as it doesn't stir up trouble, then, right, you know, that's exactly the kind of things that would be an issue, looking at it from here. But anyway, so you're seeing why I was calling this the Christmas Cold War episode. We have the U.S., Russia, and, of course, in the middle, Europe represented. By myself, Patrick Beja. But so the first topic I wanted to cover, because it was really the most, I think, the most impactful, most surprising in a way, was the ruble's value plummeting in the middle of the month, losing, actually, maybe I should look up the amount of it lost, but it plummeted to what, half of its value compared to the dollar, I think, in the past, maybe even more in the past few.
It's go about ahead. A half now. A couple of months ago, a ruble it was 36 rubles a dollar. Then, in the course of those months, it reached 80 rubles a dollar. And now it's about 56.
Okay. So it's not quite half, maybe, but it's fairly low. Let's start with maybe you, Pierre. It's the most appropriate. How did you live between you and your friends, surroundings, and the media? How did that go through, the ruble losing so much of its value in really a week or two? How did it go?
Some people, of course, panicked, but most of us have lived through the 90s, and it was far worse in the 90s, after the Soviet Union shattered. Many panicked. Some people at my work stopped working. I don't know if that if it helped them.
But were it's there...
like, oh, everything's going to hell. I'm going to quit my job.
Yeah.
No, everything's going to hell. Oh, everything's going to hell. Oh, please listen. Everything's going to hell. Oh, shit. I fucked up a deadline. Is it okay to say it?
Yeah. Go ahead. You can curse. It's fine. That's funny, though. But didn't people... I guess when we looked at it, we were thinking, first of all, it must be terrible because of the effect on the economy, and obviously the economy with outside of the country. And second of all, we thought, as you were saying, that people in the country must have been panicking and trying to dump, well, exactly what happens in this kind of crisis, trying to dump their rubles. Did it have, like, did any of your friends or yourself maybe, or I don't know, tried to maybe not buy dollars, because that would have been crazy at that point, but, you know, feel lucky that they had dollars, or, you know, try to change things on the currency on their currency holdings or anything like that? Was there this kind of movement?
It was in the news that many people did try it, though it all ended up in things like Sberbank. It's the main bank in Russia, the government bank, having no rubles. At all. I think they stopped delivering them. It was okay. In Kaliningrad or somewhere else, I think. But most of the people did think it wouldn't really matter, because their salary was still in rubles and their ongoing income was rubles, and they couldn't spend any dollars in Russia. Mm. Nothing is costed in dollars here. Even all the imported goods are translated into rubles and sold afterwards.
Well, that's, I guess, yeah, for foreigners, it has obviously a bigger effect. I've heard of many reports of, in the first day of the collapse of the ruble, people rushing to Apple stores and buying MacBooks. And those were... expatriates, so basically foreign people living in Russia, who of course all of a sudden found that, you know, whatever it was, 10,000 rubles for the price of one machine used to be, I'm going to use fictitious numbers, but obviously used to be $1,000, and all of a sudden it was 600. So they rushed to buy things. I suppose that directly affects only foreigners. But it's interesting that you're saying that people weren't really panicked, like real Russians weren't really panicked. It was really the teachings, quote unquote, of the 90s that got you to figure, well, you know, whatever, it will come back up.
Well, it didn't exactly come back up in the 90s, but everything got better. Well, I still remember when in 1997 it was, dollar was 4 rubles, next day it was 6, and so on, then it was 30.
Mm. So it's not, it's something that you've lived through a lot worse before.
Yep, and then Yeltsin said that he's tired and he's going away.
That must have been an interesting time for sure. It's funny because from our perspective, we're immediately looking at the economic partnerships and the exports and imports and the way that Russia affects the situation in Russia affects the fragile, or what we perceive to be a fragile economic state in Europe. Apparently, at least I'm talking about you and your what you know of it or what you're experiencing of it. It might be different for other people, but for you, it really, you didn't go to the economic issues. I'm curious whether it became, you know, a topic of conversation in newspapers or maybe even, you know, with coworkers or with friends, the future of, would it affect the health of the country long term, or was it just, well, whatever, you know, these things happen?
Well, these things certainly do happen, and it certainly will affect the health of the country in the long term. Some goods are suddenly much less available. Mm. For example, you've mentioned Apple. Well, I was shocked because I was going to buy myself an Apple for Christmas. So, and now I can't even get the funds to build myself a new computer.
Mm.
Because all the parts are imported and... They've all hopped up in price with the dollar.
Of course. But you don't seem to care that much. That's what's surprising me the most, actually. You're taking, from what I'm understanding at least, a very, well, you know, it seems like it doesn't matter to you a lot. And I'm not talking about just the Apple and the fact that you can't get an iPhone, but...
Well, maybe partly it helped that the food from the US and USA was banned in the summer.
Ah.
And the prices raised a bit, and they don't raise that much now.
Mm.
If the food also got more expensive with the dollar, it might have a bit more of the
psychological effect, I guess.
Psychological consequences. Though 70% of Russians live in villages. They grow their own food, even their own tobacco.
Oh.
So they don't need that much of cash.
Mm. I guess they don't rely on imports quite as much as one might think.
Well, they pity the city dwellers, and that's all.
So I have a question. Do you have an idea of how, like, is this affecting the small countries around Russia, like the ex-Soviet Union countries around the area?
It does affect Belarus.
Mm.
Okay.
They can buy Russian production, which I guess there's not a lot of it, but maybe energy, for dirt cheap, right?
Well, they can buy it, but they can't buy anything else anymore from the other countries.
Mm.
We are something like 80% of their export.
Huh.
80% of their export goes to Russia and is paid for in rubles.
Wow. Okay,
Lukashenko said that they should get to make us to pay in euros. But I don't know where it will go.
Yeah, good luck with that. it's, I guess, to start getting to the conclusion of this topic, the last thing that was kind of surprising to me was a couple of days or maybe 3 days after the beginning of the fall of the ruble, there was a TV interview by Putin. And again, in my European view of things, I was thinking, wow, he must be really nervous about this. You know, this is, he's messing up, basically. It's the first time that you see a crack in his image and his very strong leader, we do what we want and it works image. And Of course, you know, if the situation keeps going like this and it does have strong economic effects, I'm sure it would impact his image and his approval rates. But from what I understand, the way he tackled it was completely different from what I would have expected, meaning he didn't go and say, he didn't go into panic salvage mode, which I guess I'm starting to understand with what you're saying, Pierre, by which I mean it wasn't really panic, apparently, but for him, it was just, well, you know, we're not that cavalier, but, you know, this is a difficult time. It's probably going to be difficult for a while still, but we will get through it, and we have to endure. And he didn't really make a huge deal out of it. He approached it level-headedly, maybe a little bit dismissively, as from what I understood, but still, it was sort of, even for me, who am not a Russian, I'm not too closely affected by all of this. Honestly, I'm not affected at all. It sort of got me off of my semi-panic mode. I was like, oh my God, the thing is happening, and maybe it's going to do that and that. Like, trying to put myself in the shoes of a Russian, I was thinking that might be a serious thing. And the way he approached it sort of got me to, it slapped me back into place, thinking, okay, well, maybe, yes, it is a difficult thing, and maybe they can get through it, and maybe it's not the end of the world, basically, is what I got to. Yeah, well, I don't know, that's the way I approached it. But yeah, Pierre, go ahead.
The way he put it, it is routine for him, and, well, it's a nice way to look at it and to think of it while you're going through it. His task as the president was to set the mood, and right. He shouldn't have started panic.
Of course.
And it's, well, no one actually cares if we'll have to eat a bit less if other goals are achieved. Well, my mother-in-law said to me once we've got the Crimea that she doesn't care about anything. She might die now, but at least Nahimov's grave is ours.
All right, I guess it's a so, way to keep your eyes on the important issues.
Was there an effect, like you mentioned Crimea, and we've, you know, the more recently, you've got like the Ukraine stuff happening and Crimea, and has that put the country in this position to some extent with, you know, sort of extending into these areas? And I know there's been like sanctions against Russia and things like that. Has that kind of added to where Russia is at this point?
I'm sure it hasn't helped.
It hasn't helped, but I don't think it would be any better otherwise. Okay. I do believe that the Western countries just needed a reason to put sanctions towards Russia. Was it Condoleezza Rice that said back in, I don't know when, that the Siberia's riches must belong to all the nations?
You know, it's interesting that you're putting it like that, because every time I've been more and more in contact with the Russian way of thinking, might be a little bit presumptuous, but of putting it. But my wife being Finnish and Finland being very close, both geographically and in other ways, to Russia, and having traveled to Russia a couple of times in the past few years, I've been more in contact than I had been before with Russia. And there is a feeling that Russians consider, have a little bit of a, not despise, but despising, but are both proud to not be Europeans and kind of angry that Europeans don't consider Russians, when they don't consider Russians to be part of the same club, kind of. Is that a fair way of putting it, or?
I do not think this way. Russia doesn't consider itself to be European. Three-fourths of Russia are Asian.
Mm.
Some people say that there is a two-headed eagle on the Russian... I can't remember the word. Russian flag. It has a two-headed eagle. One head is towards the West, the Europe, and so on, and one is towards the Asia, towards the East.
Sure.
There is no head in between to think for them both. But...
All right. Russia
thinks of itself as a country that is separate from all the other countries surrounding it. The only thing that Russians think of as common with the other countries are the Slavic countries, brother Slavs. It has some weight.
Yeah, I see. I think it's fairly interesting to put it in that way. Russia thinks of itself as Russia. I think that's fairly good. John, have you come in contact with all of that? And I mean, beyond the, you know, Apple raising the prices on the Apple Store, which I'm sure as a tech geek you've heard about, but...
thing was them shutting it down. Yeah.
But I mean, the ruble in general, did it make waves? And surely that would be a tool for evil American propaganda declaring their superiority over, you know, their old Cold War enemy, I would guess.
I would say the average person didn't really. The only thing that hit the mass media news is when Apple pulled all their products out, because that was kind of like a whoa, you know. Okay. I'm sure it was mentioned here and there, but it's very. I mean, since the Ukraine, I don't think we've really heard that much, other than the occasional, you know, Putin was on TV, you know, making some statement. I wouldn't say it. If I were more involved in finances. That this is a big thing, because from my understanding, we're at this point, especially with Russia, we as a world are more interconnected than we've ever been before, and I should say interdependent. Mm-hmm. I think every country, you know, and especially America, you know, we have that sort of level of ignorance, I guess. But I think everyone sort of does of, yes, there's these things going on in the world, but we are insulated to a large extent, unless you're in an industry that is directly involved in that. I mean, I think I remember seeing something about, like, Russia's, whatchamacallit, like, travel agencies going bankrupt.
Right, yeah, of course. The more you have to deal with exports and that kind of thing, the more difficult it's going to be. But
yeah, and for something like that, it's like, okay, you know, it's the cost of traveling outside of Russia is enormous.
Sure, yeah.
I think even, you know, judging by what we've just heard from Pierre, like it's sort of insular there too. You know, it's like, if you don't think about how everything is interconnected, those interconnections play a very loose sort of high level effect on everyone's lives in those countries until things get really, really, really bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think those effects way later.
Possibly. All right. Okay. Well, I think that was a nice roundup of the ruble catastrophe, I might call it. I might have called it before this episode, but now I'm just going to call it the ruble undue panic in Europe, I think. Let's move. Go ahead, Pierre.
By the way, why does the Europe panic about ruble? Does Europe have something to do with the ruble?
Well, I mean, the European exports are, depending on the countries, but often important in Russia. And the energy is also, the energy that Russia sells is also important to Europe. So if things go, you know, sideways over there, it does have an effect.
Well, it's the banks too, right? The banks in Europe that gave a lot of Russian businesses loans.
Of course. There are a lot of different, you know, a lot of different effects. But
wasn't it prohibited due to sanctions?
Some of it, but I'm sure, you know, I ought to be completely honest, I don't have enough knowledge of all of it, but I know that not everything was prohibited. There were a lot of things that were that came under the sanctions, but not all of it. Not all of our economic interactions were stopped.
Can they stop things that were already going or already happened? You know, like, before the sanctions, yeah. I mean, the loans are the more long-term things that if they get defaulted on would be pretty disastrous for European banks.
Yeah,
I can see, I guess. Well, at the moment in Russia, the only people who panic are the ones who've got loans in dollars. Except, especially loans for a flat or a house.
Yeah, of course, yeah. That I mean, I'm sure we might be playing it down a little bit, but I'm sure there are actual grave effects that are already happening for a minority of people, and that could be happening more midterm. So if things don't get better, but certainly it's not as much of a panic as I would have assumed, I suppose. All right, let's turn our heads to the West and to the evil empire of the American United States with a couple of topics, one of which actually made a little bit of noise. Well, both of which made noise, but one of which comforted the blissfully unaware Europeans in their views that America is really evil. I'm joking with all of this. I hope you all understand that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, certainly the CIA reports, the U.S. Congress inquiry into CIA practices didn't help the image of the U.S. And I think even internally in the U.S., it wasn't received very warmly, I should say.
Right.
For us, the reports of torture and abuses and warrantless activities was...
Let's be clear, these aren't new reports.
Well,
These are looking at... I mean, we've all known torture and waterboarding and all these horrible things have been happening, and you've had like the Guantanamo, you know, stuff. Like,
but that was the Congress report, the official report. You know, before that it was kind of, yes, we heard through here, we had a journalist leaking this or that, there were some elements that came to light with the Snowden leaks. From my understanding, in this particular case, and specifically for the CIA, it was the first time we had a comprehensive official report on the topics.
And I think that, from my understanding, the big issue is not that it happened. I mean, that's an issue, but we've had an issue with that for a long time. I think what's new here is that they're being taken to task that it did absolutely nothing, that it didn't gain us anything. And that's what we've been saying, you know, like the party line, I think, has been for so long that we've been doing what's been necessary and the end justifies the means. And
right.
I think what this report has basically said is the means had nothing to do with the end.
Right.
It's sort of looking back going, all right, a part of our government has basically been selling our soul for no reason.
And that's what what I guess hurts the most, is it? Like that it wasn't even, is it, do people look at it and say, what the hell happened? Or
I think it depends on your point of view. I think we look at it and to me, this is American progress. Like these types of moments in American history is those moments where, you know, our government actually starts working to some extent. You know, like the government has always been a mess, and it's sort of a democracy to me is a mess that somehow manages to push through and make progress. And you have these moments where we look back, and it's this moment where we can look back and go, this didn't work. And to me, it shows a sign of hope that maybe we can change this. And if we start sort of being honest about it, so I see it as hopeful. If I were working for the CIA, it would be pretty awful. But you know, I don't see I don't see this as bringing anything new to light. I see, other than that, you know, hopefully we're holding ourselves, you know, to me, it's a sign that hopefully we're going to start holding ourselves to a higher standard, and getting over some of the 9/11 fear mongering, that still happens to this day.
Mm. So did it make some noise? It seems like it did, to maybe not to the extent that I would have assumed. It was just, well, yeah, it did make some noise.
I don't think it's
noise,
dinner conversation, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, I guess that's my question. Yes, thank you.
No, it. I don't think this is, in certain circles, this is big news. I think it's, you know, it's sort of interesting and pondering, but I think the mass, the country as a whole has larger societal concerns than the CIA.
Okay, you know what? Let's move on to those concerns. I think I know what you're referring to, although it hasn't been discussed all that much in Europe, ironically. But before we do, I want to turn to Pierre again and ask you, Pierre, how that was perceived, or if it was discussed at all, those reports of CIA abuses.
Well, it wasn't perceived much. I don't actually remember any reports beyond those of Snowden.
Okay, yeah, because that was last month. The Congress findings publishing were a few weeks ago. It's funny that it made so much noise. Maybe I'm exaggerating it a little bit. It didn't make, you know, it certainly for a couple of days was front page news in France. I think it's safe to say that. But it's funny. I would have assumed that in Russia, at least of all countries, that would have been used as a way of pointing the finger to the U.S. Although maybe if you do that, then you have to take a look at what you're doing yourself, and maybe that's something they didn't want to do. But
well, Russia doesn't actually need that much, that many means to point fingers at the U.S. The main topic of the discussion about USA was anti-Crimean sanctions.
Mm.
Yep.
Visa and MasterCard stopping to work in the Crimea, and the stuff about Sony Pictures and Korea.
Mm. Huh. Well, let's go to that for just a second.
Yeah.
I think we know how that was discussed in the West, for lack of a better denomination. How did it go in Russia?
Russians do not actually care that much. We do not like North Korea, and we do not like, on the political scale, the USA. So, well...
Well, I guess if you,
so
you
two
were
people
saying
you don't
about
particularly
it.
Like going at it, basically, is okay with you. It's like, you know, are you saying that from your point of view, it's two people that you don't really care that much for, you know, affecting each other, so thumbs up?
Well, yes, it is. It's not my only point of view, it's the way it is pointed out as in the news. Mm-hmm. It's just said about, no reflection, not anything, no anything.
Right, it's just stated...
A statement of fact.
Yeah,
kind of
neutrally,
thing.
Yep. This is what happened, okay. But so it wasn't even like, there wasn't any coloring of this discussion. It wasn't like the North Koreans, let's not go into stereotypes, but the North Koreans did something that was unacceptable, or the Americans got... retaliation for a questionable movie or anything like that. It was just, you know, and by the way, of course, it hasn't been proven that North Korea was behind all of this. I guess the U.S. did say, the U.S. government did state it was North Korea. So, yeah, officially it is. But yeah, so no real colored commentary on the thing, just factual reports.
No, not at all.
All right, that's also kind of a surprise for me. I would have guessed that at least some would have taken sides, but let's...
Well, how much, I mean, in America we have the pundits, you know, like, you know, people get paid to go on TV and spout their opinions. I mean, how much do you, in Russian media, how much do you get editorial content in the news of people, of reporters stating opinion, or is it mostly factual, or is there sort of like party line opinions that are clearly like, this is more like what we need to say because this is the this is the Russian point of view?
Just before you answer, Pierre, I just want to mention that in France, at least, it's the case in the US as well, you don't necessarily need to listen to the pundits to have not opinions, but coloring of the reporting. Have, you know, left-leaning publications and right-leaning publications. Even when they're serious journalists, the way things are presented could be betraying a little bit of the view of, and not necessarily unduly so. It's just that the way you appreciate something might be different depending on, you know, if someone... I know that in France, for example, we used to have... During the Cold War, to get back to that, we used to have a communist party, which was very strong. Obviously, the country wasn't communist, but there was an authorized communist party, and they enjoyed everything that was happening in Eastern Europe. Of course, they collapsed when things went bad for Eastern Europe in the late 80s, but... At that point, for example, if you had someone who was a supporter of the Northern Korean government, obviously that doesn't happen, but they could have said, actually, this movie is offensive and it's an insult, and, you know, reporting it that way, not necessarily being... Because it feels like the pundits that you're talking about, John, distort the truth, right? Rather than... Maybe that's an overstatement.
I would say that are more willing to espouse their opinion, like an very obviously opinion, you know, versus, you know, I definitely, there's that nuance where you can, you know, with, and I would say it's typically more with written things. I feel like our news, our media here, always, when it's on television, always has an element of opinion to it. There's always the reaction, except for a couple of key people that have always been sort of, you know, like straight line, here are the facts kind of, you know, reporters.
So you mean journalists, right? I know what you're talking about. There are too few of those. Sorry, I was making a joke.
I'm not going to start drawing lines of who's a journalist and who is not.
Right.
But... you know, we also have the problem here of, you know, the blogging versus journalism thing. And, you know, opinion is more prevalent about everything, you know, versus just here's what happened.
Right. All right. So sorry for the lengthy interruption, Pierre, but if you can remember John's question.
Because I can't.
Well, I do remember. It's not all facts in the media. In fact, on the TV, most of the people seem to be pretty much opinionated towards the government point of view.
Okay.
They seem to have to be that way.
Yeah.
Because it's much easier to close a television channel if they say something not right. I guess in the internet it's, well, quite the opposite. Maybe it's because an internet news portal is more popular if it's oppositional.
Right. Well, also, I guess, because you can't find the opposition's point of view on the traditional mass media, so...
You can't find... well, you can find much less proposition's point of view in the internet than opposition's.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the topic that I think you brought up. You wanted to bring up John, and which I think might be U.S. specific, because, well, go ahead. I think you wanted to talk about racism.
It is. I mean, it is very U.S. specific. But I'm.
So
I
let's
mean,
get
I
into,
guess I'm
into
interested
the
to
local
see...
aspect, but. The local stories are also something I want to cover, obviously. So you start with that, and of course, we'll discuss how we saw them as well.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's all right. So over the past few months, because this has been ongoing, you know, for the biggest thing for America has been the sort of increasingly. Antagonistic relationship between Black Americans and the police, and you know, culminating in police shootings, like over the top, like what I would consider. I mean, you know, when somebody dies with like 8+ bullets in them, that feels like overkill. You know, like that feel. You know, and so there's. Been multiple deaths, and more recently in my, you know, in my home's current home state of New York, there was then a retaliatory killing of two police officers. Some guy, you know, walked up to a cruiser and shot two police officers in the head and then went and killed himself. Yeah. And it is probably the most disturbing. This is one of those things where it is such an ongoing central core part of America that I think it's difficult to look beyond. You know, it's like it's the, you know, you don't it's not polite to bring up politics and or religion in a conversation with people. Racism is the is the probably the biggest elephant in the American room. And
are you saying people aren't talking about it at the water cooler?
People are, because we can't avoid it, but it's very easily heated. And I would say these days the water cooler is like Facebook comments.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I always sit in the middle of these types of issues. And I've grown up with the ability to kind of see all sides of most issues. And
that's a really powerful superpower, by the way.
It's really conflicting because it's really hard to actually have an opinion on something.
Right.
And also I tend to, you know, take the opposite opinion for the sake of taking the opposite opinion, which kind of annoys people. But I have plenty of people that I know that are like, you know, you see two extremes of the, you know, you see the police are evil thing, and then you see the police can do no wrong, position.
Yeah.
And I think both are really dangerous opinions. And it's just there is this element of fear. And I feel some fear when dealing with a police officer. There's an element of, you know, like if I get pulled over or something like that, I feel like if I do something to piss this guy off, my life is going to be made a living hell. And that is a very small degree of feeling in comparison to what I can only imagine it feels like to be a Black American dealing with the police. And I've had conversations with friends about this, and I don't know what it feels like to be afraid for my life when dealing with a police officer.
You know, it's just to interrupt you for just a second to add to what you were saying. Obviously, it's absolutely not the same in the case I'm going to talk about. But when I travel to the U.S., I do feel a tiny, you know, there's always this tiny bit of fear in the back of your mind that when you're going through customs, you're going to say the wrong thing. Or if you talk to a cop, it doesn't even happen. So it's somewhat irrational. And maybe that illustrates the image of the police officer in the US, which is perpetuated by either stereotypes of or these kinds of news reports, but or even, you know, it might be something about TV shows. I don't think so, but maybe. There's certainly a way that the authorities, these kinds of authorities in the US carry themselves or seem to be acting that makes me more uncomfortable than I think I should be. And it's certainly not the same way when we are interacting with the authorities in France. And, you know, I'm a white male. I'm privileged. I live in a relatively well-off neighborhood. So I don't want to compare my experience in France to anyone else's anywhere. But I just wanted to add in that and it's not like the customs officer are going to get up of their booth and shoot me. It's just that there's this feeling that, and I'm going to curse just a little bit here, it's like, fuck, I shouldn't say the wrong thing. And maybe it should be like that at the customs. But anyway, it affects me too. That feeling that you have, even,
it's a fear of power. Yeah. Like the other person very clearly has power over you. And
but it feels like there's a level of immunity. Not immunity, but I don't know, more power, unchecked power. Maybe that's the way I can phrase it best. But
yeah. And I for me to try and relate to someone who is in that position, I have to take those feelings that are in the back of my head and amplify them 100-fold, I think.
Sure.
And then I feel like I can start to imagine what that might feel like. And I hope that we as a country can move to a place of when there's less fear. And I think that's the biggest issue right now is, you know, you have this level of fear on the police officer's part and this level of fear on, you know, someone just walking around a neighborhood in, you know, in a city and so there's
you
fear
mean the level,
is essentially the
fear,
biggest.
The level of fear on the officer's part you're talking about is basically anyone could be carrying a weapon and could be shooting at you if you're...
Right, they're putting their life on the line, and I fully acknowledge that what they do is difficult, scary, and
dangerous.
Very dangerous. And I would like to see... I want to see discussions of, you know, ways to put them in less danger, and for them to be better trained, to be, you know, like, it's just like it's just strange that we've gotten to this point where the institutional fear and institutional racism, because I think it's there, is just getting to a fevered pitch, and maybe it's one of those things where it has to get worse before it can get better. But I think we've come to a place as a country that is on its way to getting better, and it's just very difficult to get over that hump. You know what I mean?
I
and the closer you get, the harder it gets, kind of thing.
Yeah. Pierre, of course, feel free to, you know, jump in anytime you want. But I do get a question in my mind that comes very naturally, and I'm sure is going to upset portions of the audience, but did none of this conversation evolve into the question of the right to bear arms?
Because right for me, now, just, I think
just to explain, for me, it's an obvious one. You know, it's thinking, well, it's very dangerous for the cops, and they get twitchy and you know, maybe too scared because arms are everywhere and anyone could be carrying one.
Problem,
and of course, someone is going to say,
is
they could
most,
get
I
weapons
think most
anyway.
Of the issues that they have, I think that they're not afraid of somebody who has the right to bear arms carrying a thing. I think most, I mean, if you look at it, most of these cop-involved shootings, like, you always
it's
have
illegal,
the element
it's
of
illegal
the illegal
guns.
Arms.
Of course, no, that's obvious. That's obvious, of course. What I'm saying is everyone has guns. Not everyone, but of course when you have, there are too many guns in the country could become a question, illegal
right, so
or
here,
not.
Here's
and
how it comes.
When
here's
you
how it's
have
talked
a
about.
Culture of, that's a different issue. But I'm just. It's just strange that no one looks at the reason for everyone being afraid is that everyone's pointing guns at one another. Now, whether or not that has to do with the right to bear arms or the illegal arms or the, you know, all of that, it's like, well, when everyone's having a gun pointed at everyone else's head, sometimes things go bad.
Well, it's funny though, because I think you're pointing out a part of the sort of the issue of racism here and guns and things like that is we don't, in these instances, we don't talk about the right to bear arms. We talk about the right to bear arms when a white guy walks into a school with a gun and shoots a bunch of people.
Right.
And that's,
how
I mean, the mass.
A gun in the US.
How easy? Yeah. It's both hard and easy at the same time. It's very strange. There's a lot of contradictory things. Like, you go into a store to buy a gun, and of course this varies from state to state, which is, you know, part of the issue. Each state has the right to govern themselves in this regard. But you will have states that are very strict for, like, you walk into a store, it takes X amount of times, you got background checks, you can't have mental, any signs of mental issues in your past or what have you. But you can then go to a gun show and buy the same gun immediately. In the same state. So there's a lot of weird contradictory issues. But
so basically, if someone wants to get a gun, it's not too difficult.
But I think there's this element of socioeconomic issue here where that the likelihood, it's just when you talk about people buying guns, it's typically white people or people of a more affluent,
It's interesting that we're really framing the issue differently. And I think maybe and with Pierre's question as well, I think both of us are making it about something that it isn't at its core for you, and you, I mean the Americans. But for me, it is so obvious that that's part of the issue. And when you're framing it by saying, well, the right to bear arms affects people being able to buy guns, but these guys are getting guns anyway without buying them, you're sort of saying it wouldn't matter whether or not the right to bear arms was there or not.
And I'm not trying to say that. I'm saying that that is my perception of the conversation. Like, I am pointing out that the conversation in the United States never talks about that. And I think you're right. It's a strange sort of thing. But at the same time,
but what I was getting at was in our countries, I mean, I don't want to speak for Pierre, but in France at least, guns are a lot more regulated and controlled, and you very, very, very rarely hear about shooting issues. It happens sometimes, but it's very rare.
In Russia,
sorry, Pierre,
too.
Go ahead.
In Russia, it is too very rare for such shootings to begin. Arms are very regulated due to the 90s situation.
Mm. Yeah. So.
I think that would probably help. I think the issues that come up in regards to this are, I think it's one of those things of like there's like, I don't know, probably five or six major issues that come up as a result of this. And whoever's bringing up the issue is going to bring up the issues that's most important to them. And so the voices are talking about, control. Like the biggest thing right now they're trying to do is push for body cameras on cops, which I think is great. You know, like more oversight and regulation and accountability. Accountability is never a bad thing. And
I think when I was saying unchecked power, that might be a way to address it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so if they have a feeling of they need, it's this weird. And I think social media has created this weirdness with police as well. It's like, they feel like they can't do their job because what they're doing is being judged by the entire world because they're being watched. But that's, I don't see that as a bad thing. I feel like, if you're afraid of being judged by outside, then you're probably not doing something right.
Yeah. I mean, to an extent. And it's a way of addressing the issue. I can see how it could be problematic in some cases, but
I think the bigger issue, and I don't really want to get, I just want to point out the bigger issues are the institutionalized racism, and by that I mean like the prison system in America. I don't I think ours is fairly unique in that it's a privatized system that is for profit, and that is very disturbing. And the sheer number of Black Americans that are, the percentage of people who are jailed, the sort of the bias towards white Americans, and the war on drugs, the war on drugs that is really not doing anything other than feeding money into the prison system. So there are some big major issues, and it's really a long ongoing process. I don't know where are you guys in your parts of the world at with those types of issues, or in terms of like prisons and drugs and things like that? How do you feel your those institutions are working for you guys?
I think it's I'll go for France first. It's certainly all of these issues that you're mentioning are present here as well, maybe a little bit less intense. Okay, I'm going to say a lot less intense. But they're here too. We have some issues with drugs, not incredible. We have more issues with racism. We have, as we were talking about last time, significant portions of the population which are first or second or third generation immigrants from Northern Africa mostly, and that creates a division in society. It's certainly a socioeconomic issue because, as it's the case in the US, a lot of the suburbs are more poor and populated with immigrants, or these second, third generation immigrants who came after the war to rebuild the country. And that's an issue. The prison system is certainly not working perfectly either. And that's an understatement. So I would say we have all of these issues, and the issue of weapons is one that comes to my mind maybe a little bit too quickly. I think I might have derailed the conversation that was initially about racism and socioeconomic issues, because for me,
it's an obvious, easy one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you're right. It's very strange to me that we haven't done more, but that's democracy for you. We have lobbyists and things like that are stopping a lot of that from going through.
Yeah. Pierre, any thoughts on all of this story?
Well, in Russia, crime in general is a separate culture since Stalin Russia, or maybe even Tsarist Russia. So prison system hasn't
changed that much from back then, as well as many regulations. Well, they do evolve, of course, but, well, it works. Nobody cares that much. It doesn't actually do the thing it should, I believe. But I have never seen a prison or heard of a prison that actually changes people in a way that they will do crimes no more or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think in France or even the US that that portion, which is arguably the most important one, doesn't work either. But I guess
rehabilitation doesn't happen. I think is it creating more than it's fixing? You know, like is it creating more problems than solving them? And I feel like ours is definitely on that end.
Yeah.
So is ours. Well, if a person goes to prison, most likely he will either be broken by the end of the term, or he will get some connections in the crime circles, and neither is good.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So just to finish up on that, we haven't heard about all of these issues too much in France. The American ones, we heard about Ferguson when it first started, but I think we got tired of it after that. And it's one of the things that has been the most prominent, from what I can see on social networks, and it's been going on for months. It's sort of, it gets to the level of really internal politics that doesn't affect France enough that it's going to become an important topic of a conversation here.
I wouldn't even call it internal politics, although I mean it's
sure
it's
a, not politics
it's,
but
it,
news.
Yeah, but yeah, it's a massive societal issue, and it keeps coming up. Like it's like I don't, and it's probably a good thing, not the killings obviously, but it's good that the conversation is going, because a lot of these types of things, the conversation comes, like you were saying, with the gun control. Gun control only comes up for about a month after a mass killing. Then it goes away. And we stop talking about it. And it's like, we need to actually finish some of these conversations.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how this one is going to go, because it's so difficult and so important at the same time. And anyway, I'm sure we'll have a chance to discuss it more on this very show in the future. I think that might do it for us, unless either of you have another topic you want to discuss?
Well, not another topic, but I just wanted to comment on the Ferguson thing.
Oh, sure, go ahead, of course.
It certainly did get useful for Russia. For some sort of Cold War rhetorics, as in, hey, you Russians, you are bad, you've annexed Crimea. Well, and you've got black people being shot at on the street. It's a way of talking that was pretty much popular in the Cold War, and it seems that U.S. have unlearned to answer it.
So it was being, you mean Ferguson was being used in the media in Russia as a way of answering the question of Crimea?
Well, yep, the Crimea and Ukraine and everything. As in, they say we are bad while we are just defending our country, and they're having such horrible things on the street.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's something that I wouldn't have expected Russia to use as an example, because there are so many, you know, outwards. I guess, yeah, it's logical when you're looking at Crimea and saying, well, this is our country. It should be part of Russia. And you talk about internal issues in the U.S. I guess that does make sense. Probably more to a Russian national than for us, but because we often look at, you know, Crimea being part of Ukraine. So for us, it was an international issue, not an internal one. But Maybe just a few words about Cuba. I guess the the relaxing of the relationships with Cuba that was recently announced by President Obama was basically discussed in an interesting way for us here. It was very often put in parallel with Russia again. Russia is at the center of all of our discussions today.
Russia is at the center of most things. Well, I shouldn't say that, at the center of most things. I should say it always feels to me like Russia, it's like, this is happening. How's Russia responding to this? You know, like it's
yeah. Recently, it's become that.
Yeah, it's been an ongoing sort of I think an involvement. But go ahead.
So yeah, in the case of you know the relationships with Cuba, it was in France. It was looked at and saying, well, they're okay. They're agreeing to deal with Cuba, but they really don't want to have anything to do with. They don't want to deal or. We've been discussing this with my wife, and one of her, I can't remember if we discussed it last episode when we talked about Russia, one of her arguments was you have to understand Russia and be able to accommodate a little bit of what they want if you want the conversation to even happen. And it seems like Obama is now willing to do that with Cuba, and certainly the conversation is completely different because it's not at all the same country and it's not the same situation. So it's a little bit of
I think
unfair...
the power dynamics are different. And
exactly,
I think that's
exactly.
probably the most important thing. You know,
yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
of course, when you have the advantage,
you can be magnanimous.
Of course you're willing to talk.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the way it was portrayed. And not in a judgmental way in France. It was just, oh, so, you know, they're okay to talk with Cuba, but they don't want to talk with Russia. Maybe in implying that it was more important to find a way to speak with Russia than it was to speak with Cuba. I think that
right.
was the underlying
like
message.
We're spending why are we spending our time doing this when we should be fixing our relationship with Russia?
Well, no, not really. I think everyone thought it was a great thing that,
okay.
you know, finally relationship with are being normalized with Cuba. No one was saying, don't waste your time on this crap. Everyone was thinking, yes, that's awesome. It's also really important to apply this kind of open-mindedness with Russia because we have to talk to them.
Right.
I'm obviously curious to hear how the Cuba thing was received in Russia.
Well, it wasn't received much, though. It was a bit sad that the Cubans do agree to talk to the US after such a long time.
So it was basically seen as the Cubans giving up, or?
Well, maybe Cubans are giving up on Russia, though they've claimed they're not to change their way of life in any way afterwards. So I cannot think of what will come of it later. Mm.
Was that something that was... presented that was put forward, like the fact that actually the Cubans are saying they're not going to change their ways, that doesn't mean they're changing their ways?
Well, I do believe so. Yes, it was mentioned in the news.
Hmm. Huh. That's funny. That's something that was not mentioned at all in our news. So. All right, let's conclude this with John's American view on that Cuba thing. And then we can all go back to preparing for the new year.
So the American view of this, I mean, my personal view is great, about time. Okay. Let's move it forward, you know?
Let me guess American view is. The American view is... the Republicans hate it and the Democrats love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we look at it at, you know, Obama doesn't have that much time left. And Obama has very little ability to get much done. So I think, you know, and it's kind of like, what can I do? You know what I mean? Like, he's fighting. He, you know, I look at it as he's trying to enact as much change in a short amount as possible that he can guarantee he can do. And, you know, win the battles you can and let the other battles go because they're not worth fighting anymore. And so I see, you know, I see these sort of things as a distraction, as sort of like a, you know, giving up to some extent, but, you know, and of course a big middle finger, I think, to the Republicans. It'll be interesting to see what happens next presidential election. I don't know, but we're back in the there is a wave, a pattern to our politics that has been going on for quite a long while, and pretty much every president for the past 30-ish years, loosely 40 maybe, has been going through like their final years have been against, you know, have been always taken over by the other party in the Congress. So the you know, it basically always ends up in this deadlock at the end of a presidential term, where the, you know, nothing can quite get done. Which I think is sad, you know, a huge waste of time, but it's, you know, the nature of the beast.
Well, especially since in the beginning, you have the election, it takes a while to get your things in place, and then you have the midterms you have to think of, and then re-election, and then
the
other midterms.
We spend way too much time thinking about getting elected, I should say. Congress and politicians spend way too much time thinking about getting elected.
Well, it's the nature of the game, but yeah. It's funny because we've had Sarkozy, the former president, making a resurgence and making some interesting claims that, you know, he was talking about the gay marriage, basically marriage for everyone, that was passed by the current administration in France. And he was claiming that he would repeal it, which is practically impossible. And it's interesting that in the Republicans were also, from what I've heard, claiming that they would repeal the relaxing of the relationship, or change the relaxing of the relationships with Cuba, when it seems pretty obvious that in 2 years they're not going to risk anything at that point if they're elected. So
no one will care anymore. It's, you have to, I think, all citizens of all countries with any reasonable amount of politics have to look at it and go, okay, what's them stating their views and what's actually realistic that they could do? Because you're right. I mean, there are certain things that will happen and just will not get undone because it's not worth undoing. And they get a lot more political capital out of railing against it and talking about it than they do out of actually doing anything about it.
All right. I think this is going to bring us to a close of this Christmas. How did I call it?
Yeah.
Christmas Cold
Happy
War?
Happy Christmas.
Yeah, it is Christmas. I'm guessing...
Happy holidays.
I'm guessing, yeah, holidays. Let's be inclusive.
Inclusive, yeah.
I guess, Pierre, you're doing... In Russia, you're doing the Orthodox Christmas, so it's not Christmas yet, right?
Well, we are doing Orthodox Christmas, though I do believe that it's not right to choose if Christmas is 25th of December or the 7th of January. So we do celebrate from 25th to the 7th.
That's a nice way of doing it. You can have a little bit more Christmas time in that way. That's pretty an interesting way of looking at it. All right. Excellent. Thank you so much to both of you for coming on. Thank you, Pierre, for being on your first podcast ever. I hope it was an enjoyable time. We didn't cut you off too much.
Well, it was an enjoyable time.
Oh, good. Okay, cool. Excellent. Do you have any, I don't know, something you can you want to pimp? Do you have a Twitter account people can follow, or some other public internet activity?
Well, I do have a Twitter account, but it's purely in Russian. It's at Stylisa, T-Y-L-E-E-S-A.
Tylisa. Well, you know what? We will put it in the show notes so people can come follow you if they want to speak Russian, or, you know, already do speak Russian. There might be a few in the show. Thanks so much for being on, Pierre. John, what about you, my friend?
I'm not sure why people would want to follow me at this particular point in time, because I'm not particularly talkative, but you can follow me on Twitter at Copperdome, Copperdome. And, you know, I'm not sure what to pimp at this point. You know, other than I just, you know, I'm an app designer, so you can buy some apps. I did release a holiday app, which is kind of pointless now. since the holidays are essentially over. I had a lot of fun.
Well, you don't know. I mean, you know, apparently Pierre is celebrating Christmas from now until the 7th. So,
yeah, we made a little good deeds sort of list for kids to you know, like, you know, work up to Christmas and, you know, try and, you know, earn. It's sort of a gamified, like, you know, here's some ideas of good deeds. And then as you do them, you earn ranks with Santa. It was a lot of fun to make. And we had, my wife did all the VO work for it. And we got our friend Joel Duggan to do some character
what's the name of the app?
Illustrations.
I'm on the edge of my holiday seat, man.
It's called Holiday Heroes. It's maybe next year it'll be worth doing. But it's a fun little app. And if you have kids.
A website for it, or is it just on the
app stores? Yes. You can search. Obviously, you can search for it on the iOS App Store. You can also get a link directly to it from holidayheroesapp.com.
Excellent.
Thanks. Two P's per usual.
Of course. Thanks very much, John. In my case, you can follow me on Twitter at notpatrick. I forgot my Twitter handle for a second there. You can also listen to the show and others at frenchspin.com, which is the website where I host this show and the other ones I do. And even more importantly, if you're feeling generous and if you think you've gotten something out of this show and you would like it to keep going strong, there is a way to support the show and to support my professional podcasting endeavors in general. And you can go to patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link is on the show notes, on the podcast itself, and on the website at frenchspin.com. But you can do that, as have a few dozen people who are supporting the show financially, and I'm very, very thankful too, especially in this holiday and thankfulness period. If you think you might want to support a show like this and an idea like the one we're promoting here, do go around to the Patreon site and watch the video, look around, see if there's something that might be motivation enough for you to participate. It would be very much appreciated. I'm trying to build something more out of this show, and this will help me get there. So patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The links are everywhere. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you all have a wonderful holiday period, since Christmas is not the only one and it's also gone. So, or for some of us, I don't want to piss off the Russians.
Anger the bear.
Yes, no, they will come and wrestle bears in Paris. It will be chaos. So thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoy your holidays and have a wonderful new year. Thanks so much to Pierre and John, and we'll be back in about a month. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.